Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Professor Silvio Micali, ACM Turing Award recipient in 2013, and the Turing Award is widely considered the Nobel Prize of Computing. Professor Silvio Micali is also a world-renowned distinguished researcher and a professor at MIT. Now, Silvia, you have a lifetime of outstanding research contribution with lasting, significant global impact. Thank you for coming in today and sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Hey, thank you, Stephen. It's a pleasure talking to you and your audience.
Now, Silvia, you have this extraordinary honor. Now, when did you hear about this, and how did you feel at the time? What was the reaction of your colleagues and your family?
Well, actually, I heard that on a Friday afternoon, we were planning to leave for a ski trip, actually with my colleague Shafi, my co-recipient of the Turing Award. So that was quite a coincidence, you may say. And the telephone rang, and then we started talking about it during our trip to the ski slopes. Okay, so how do I feel? I felt good, right? I felt good in particular to have won it with Shafi. You must know that we actually were graduate students together. We worked for many years, overcome many difficulties, even multiple rejections of our work, right, before we got an award. And so, I was very happy to get it together with her, and it was a good interaction. And, in some sense, we were trying to develop a fear of interaction, and to interact, we must be two. And when you interact with Shafi, you're actually interacting with at least seven people, depending on multiple personalities and who is in charge on that day. So, that was, how I felt, but my colleagues actually was very happy to see that there was a very large positive reaction. So you must know that, we are a very interactive community. We collaborate a lot, across institution. I put a premium on their positive opinion. So I'm glad to see that it was positive. Some of them actually were so kind that we were even almost happier when we were. That's not to say that, of course, some of them did not react at all. So some may disagree on the importance of the results or take them for granted. Whatever the case, it's important, to have dissenting opinion, as you know, right? So in any case, I felt that overall was very positive, and my family was ecstatic, okay? So that's how I could describe it.
Well, I can see how your family would be very pleased because you're a legend, you're an icon in the industry, and of course this lives forever, that you're part of the historical record forever.
Well, the UN forever, well, that is good enough for us, right?
Now, Silvio, how will the ACM Turing Award impact your work, your influence, and your thinking?
Oh, wow, so that is thinking of, So to tell you the truth, on one side, we should strive for absolute truth, novelty, right? But on the other side, we should strive, or at least I do strive, also for universal recognition. So somehow this coexisting goals is good, in my opinion, when you go down to it, right? Because assume that the pursuit of absolute truth required disregarding of social judgment, we would have a lot of trouble in our hands. Okay, so that said, it's not to say that that recognition and strive for truth are antagonistic, right? They can be. They can be antagonistic, and in the short term, somehow, if you desire universal recognition, that means that you have to work on problems that everybody perceives to be important. In other words, that requires pursuing a more established and conservative line of research. So, what do I hope from the doing? That it takes care of some of the desire for recognition, at least, right? And then it leaves me free to go on a limb and take some more scientific risk, so to explore new wilderness, so to speak. So that is for the impact that I hope for my work. As for my influence, Let's see. First of all, I have nothing against, recognition, gaining you some influence. After all, we work very hard to increase our reputation. So my peers, will continue to judge my work, according to strict standards, and they do right at doing so, right? However, for, researchers outside the field, I do see that, the Turing may naturally can give some additional influence, and I hope I can use it wisely when interacting with scientists from other disciplines. And finally, if I may add another thing, it's always awards, right, have a good property to try to make us feel good. So if you feel good, you can do more things, more energy. So I hope to put it at work in my thinking, teaching, work, and everything else.
Now, again, you have this amazing body of work, and you've got this significant achievement in the ACM Turing Award. From that, then, what are your life goals that you want to achieve, and how will you achieve them?
So, well, life goals, these are hefty, it's a difficult question, Stephen. So, it's so personal that, it may actually, that if I answer truthfully, I will be a little bit enigmatic, okay? So, my goals, essentially is one goal, if you want, is to understand the world and to be understood. And in my mind, these actually are quite the same. So how to achieve it, is by understanding myself, understanding others. Actually, more than understanding, really getting into the minds of others and letting them into mine if I can. And finally, you need the combination of supreme confidence and supreme doubt.
Okay, we're now going to talk about your work that led to the Turing Award. And this first question is, what led you to co-write one of the most influential papers in computing science as a graduate student in 1983?
All right. So then, if you want me to outline the the story of that work, I'll tell you is a tale of fearlessness and shameless luck, ignorance, everything combined. Okay. So let me start with luck. So I'm not ashamed to start with luck because nothing substantial can be accomplished without it. Right. So my good luck was to be in Berkeley in a wonderful atmosphere with fantastic teachers and great fellow students. In particular, I was lucky to be in a course taught by Manuel Bloom on computational number theory, whose last three lectures, maybe three or four, no more actually, were on public key cryptography. So cryptography at that point was not that developed, at least in academia. And so Manuel was an absolutely inspiring teacher. Cryptography was and is incendiary material, so there was a match made in heaven in if you allow me to pun, the match lit, okay? So that was how we started. So now, a problem mentioned in class was this of a mental poker, right? In other words, the idea is, can you and I play cards over the phone, by email, right? So there was an approach to this problem proposed in the past, but did not quite work. So Shafi and I decided, to solve it, and that's where fearless and shameless come handy, right? Because the problem was actually very hefty, and a satisfactory solution would have taken years of development and many more techniques that we had at the time. And we actually ultimately built those. But at the time, our youth and inability to properly size the problems were a big help in taking on this challenge. And even if we try to scale down version, we essentially thought about encrypting the cards and then implementing the dealing, the random shuffling of the card, was actually big enough to make us understand that we needed a new encryption scheme and a new notion of security. Okay, so I guess that, so without getting into too many details, right? But encryption, so, let's see, at that time, was deterministic, right? So, which means that every message used to have a single ciphertext corresponding to it, right? And message length, I mean, technically speaking, I should say entropy, but never mind. So, you can imagine that it's hard to guess a long message in its entirety, right? But at that time, if you were lucky, saying you could guess the message in its entirety and the encryption is deterministic, then you can actually verify the correctness of your guess. So what makes, mental problem really challenging here, mental poker really challenging, is that the possible messages are only 52, because there are only 52 cards. So in principle, it's very easy to cycle through all of them, right? So the message space, so to speak, is very, very sparse. And so we decided that if we wanted to encrypt such a few messages, we had to encrypt them probabilistically. That means that we had to flip coins to choose a ciphertext of a message. So think of it like this. I have not a one way to encrypt a message, but I have, you know, many, 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 many ways, even exponentially many ways, and I flip coins to choose which one I should select. And then I send you the ciphertext, okay? Now, the property should be aware that even though every message can be ciphered in so many ways, for every single one of them, you can actually retrieve the original message that I sent you, right? So that essentially is the idea. And actually, we decided to further generalize. If 52 were not enough, we decided, well, we'll make it a situation worse. How about if you want to encrypt only a 0 or 1, right? If you want to encrypt a single bit. So we wanted to make sure in such a case, says, what do we want from an encryption? So we want that an adversary who captures a ciphertext of a single bit, he should not be able to guess what it means with probability better than 50-50. So, mind you, 50-50 everybody can get, right? So either if you don't know anything about encryption at all, you see a ciphertext, you flip a coin, you say, if head, I predict 0, if tail, I predict 1, you flip the coin, and you'll be right with probability a half. So you must be do tiny, teeny, an epsilon better, as we say. So maybe think about 51% or 50.1% or 50.001%, something like this. So we should be forbidden, right? And so essentially we were developing a notion that later on we called computational indistinguishability. And we actually proved our first theorem that if, and with this big if, we were able to encrypt the message this way, single bit this way, when we can encrypt arbitrarily many multi-bit messages also as security. And so that was a technique that came to be known like a hybrid argument. So at this point, we knew what we wanted thanks to this hybrid argument of this theorem, that we wanted to encrypt securely a single bit. The only problem left was how to find to encrypt securely a single bit. And somehow at this point, we needed a candidate, right, to implement our mental poker game or to our encryption system. And that is actually where ignorance came to the rescue. And not only ignorance and luck again, of course, because assuming you know a lot of things is tantamount to having a haystack in your mind, right? But what you want among all these many, 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 many pieces of straw, you want to have one special straw, the needle, right? But this means trouble because you may never find it in such in so many pieces of straw, or you may find it when it's too late. So we were lucky because we didn't know much on computational number theory. So whatever facts we had to put together to construct our candidates, we knew very few facts. So if it worked at all, we had to put together the few facts that we knew. And so somehow we got lucky because the needle was possible to construct or to find in this small stack, and we zero in on a problem, quadratic residuosity, which essentially means whether you can distinguish a square from a non-square modulo n when n is a large number whose factorization you do not know. And I will not bother you with the details, but you can actually disregard some numbers from being a square modulo n, but then there is another half of the numbers that you cannot disregard at all, and that seems to us that, say, might be useful to somehow encrypt a single bit. So, we start asking our advisor, we start asking our other authorities, and somehow nobody knew how to solve this quadratic residuosity problem. So we say, what the heck, we adopted as our crypto system, let's assume it is hard, we took the risk, right? Why do I say risk? Because, the danger was that, after publication of a scheme, somebody can come up, the next day and say, hey, what are you talking about, quadratic residuosity? Here is how to solve it. So, but we took the risk, again, we were young, remember, so, you know, we didn't have a reputation to maintain yet, or perhaps we had the disregard of reputation, so whatever. So together with this, together with ignorance and luck and the rest, things worked out. So at that point, actually, we understood things along the way, too. So if quadratic residuosity were become easy tomorrow, it would not be a problem, because at this point we have, you know, enough candidates for these hard bits that we needed for base our crypto system on. In fact, actually, we have a way to distill them. So in some sense, timing was crucial, and timing is another form of luck, right? So by the way, I think I made it clear that I strongly believe that never mind, you know, all our good deeds and whatever we do to deserve what our successes, you know, luck is a big part, right? I mean, I'm Italian, right? So my ancestors, the Romans, I mean, those guys, they were very determined people. They conquered a lot of the known world, but at the end, they knew really whom to thank. And, you know, they built a monumental temple to luck, to fortune. In fact, actually, it was a, if you ever go to Rome, or everybody goes to Rome, and you take a trip nearby to Palestrina, there is an entire mountain transformed into a temple. So the temple of luck. So, I mean, at the end, luck matters. So, but, you know, but then, you know, you have to work for your luck. So we develop, you know, various techniques, in particular random self-reducibility to help us prove that quadratic residuosity, the problem we selected, really had all the property we wanted. We had this hybrid argument. We had the computational distinguishability. And so these were actually techniques that we introduced in probabilistic encryption for a particular context, but these also were the techniques that proved crucial in subsequent and harder contexts. So in some sense, we were lucky or wise again to use them in a simpler problem to begin with.
Well, it's a particularly amazing piece of work, and it reflects an inflection point in history, the work that you did. And when you talk about luck, I guess luck, that's where preparation and opportunity meet. So.
Absolutely. Luck favors the prepared, but luck is needed anyway.
Now, can you provide added details behind your approach, the simulation paradigm?
Sure. You know, it's the simulation paradigm, actually, I find it that is the most natural thing, okay? So, but, you know, but I want to know, forget the mathematics for a minute, right? So, and let me put you in the right mood. It's a simple concept, really. It's a very human concept. So let me start with a kind of, you know, a personal episode, okay? Which I'm sure is actually common to all of us, right? And yet is very personal to all of us. So, okay, so here we go. So I remember I was a kid, and somehow I got an acute attack of classic solipsism. I mean, which is a fancy word to say that I started being fearful there was no outside reality, right? It was all in my head. That I was alone, the world was a product of my imagination, et cetera, et cetera. And now, it could very well be in a power trip. I'm sure it was, but somehow, at the time, I recall the feeling to be one of loneliness, despair, and so on and so forth. So my mother got worried, you know, it lasted a few days. She sat next to my bed to me and said, listen, what are you saying? You know, so I'm here, I do exist, let me help you. And I said, no, you're not here. Placed you next to me in my bed. I'm letting you say these things and so on and so forth. So I eventually got out of it, right? But then I was able to put it into positive form, all these feelings, all this notion in science. So what impressed me at the time, I remember distinctively how impossible it was to break that symmetry. I mean, to decide which was virtual and which was real. And then, you know, if I could not distinguish the real from the virtual, in what sense could they be considered different? Somehow that thought stuck with me. And fast forward a few decades, and now here is the simulation paradigm. So what is the simulation paradigm? Essentially, it's a technique that ensures that no information or not much information is leaked, okay? So in cryptography, there is not you, Steven, or me, Silvio, right? So what distinguishes you from anybody else is a secret that you have. It's called a secret key in crypto term lingo. And so that is a secret number that only you know. And then what you do is that you use this secret key to send, say, proper messages in a cryptographic transaction or whatever. Now, of course, nobody's going to be so dumb to send his or her own secret key along with his messages in a crypto protocol. But you use your secret key to generate the messages you send. So in some sense, somebody who sees the messages you send essentially sees kind of your secret projected as the shadow of your secret projected on an imaginary wall, on an hypothetical wall, right? And perhaps if an adversary sees enough shadows of your secret object, say from many angles, he could reconstruct your key, right? So you don't know the shape of this object, but say, I've seen a projection on this wall, I've seen a projection on this other wall, I started getting a zest of it, and perhaps I actually can reconstruct it. So essentially, when you're using a cryptographic protocol, you are in a bind. If you never use your secret key, the secrecy of the key is guaranteed. But you're not doing anything cryptographic relevant either. On the other hand, if you use your secret key, which you must do to accomplish anything of interest, you actually reveal shadow images of your secret key. So, will it remain secret at the end? So somehow the solution of the riddle is to send messages using your secret key in a way that the adversary, without knowing your secret key, can simulate you, can reproduce what you say in essentially the exact same way in which you say things. So by watching you, the adversary watches your reality, but you ensure that he, without knowledge of your secret key, is able to generate a virtual reality which is actually identical to the one you generate for him. And if this succeeds, your secret is secure. Why? Because if he could imitate what you say without knowing your secret key, then what you say cannot inadvertently betray your secret key. So that's the whole idea, right, of how to somehow contain the amount of information and what the simulation paradigm gives you. So if you go back now to the solipsism, I could not solve whether the world is real or is, I'm making my own virtual reality. But at least I could put to good use, right? So that because the impossibility of distinguishing reality from creation of our mind, now is our best way to guarantee the security of a cryptographic protocol. Now, if I can maybe abuse of your patience, maybe a little bit more to give you an example, okay? So you say, okay, but this is all empty words, hypotheticals over hypotheticals. What is an example? Okay, let's go back to encryption, which is the simplest possible example, right? So in public encryption, what do you do? So assume that you select a specific secret message, right? You encrypt it, say, in my key, probabilistically, and then you send to me the resulting ciphertext. Call it C. C is a good acronym, right, for a ciphertext. Okay, so assume now that there is an adversary between us, and what does his real view? His real view is this string C, the ciphertext that you have actually so produced. Okay, however, the adversary has certainly the following virtual view we can reconstruct without knowing your specific message at all. Essentially, the adversary, nothing stops him from choosing a random message, a creature of his own mind without any objective reference, right? Encrypts it probabilistically using my public key to obtain a virtual ciphertext D that nobody sent, and then looks at D. So now the adversary has actually two worlds. One C that you created by encrypting your specific message, M call it, and one D that the adversary himself created probabilistically by encrypting a random message. And if a crypto system guarantees that his real view, this C, ciphertext, and his virtual view, the D that himself created, are essentially indistinguishable, then the secrecy of your specific message is safe. Okay? Now that is the simulation paradigm means in encryption, and the principle is the same across other applications. It may actually become a little bit harder to implement and to grasp, but the idea is the same.
Now, can you further describe your notions of encryption security, for example, semantic security and distinguishability, and how these measures must be met for schemes to provide security across a wide range of cryptographic applications?
All right. So we are going from technical to more technical. Okay. Let me try. So semantic security is essentially what you want from an encryption scheme. In some sense, it coincides with what, Shannon wanted from perfect secrecy. But then they proved that you cannot quite have it, okay? Or you can only encrypt a single message if you have shared with your associate a random secret number beforehand. So what happens in a message? So you know that, whatever the context is, that, somebody is going to transmit a message. And so you have just a probability distribution, or we call it a message space, of what he's going to say, right? And very often, this nobody can tell you, right? So say, assume that the message space consists of all messages which are 1,000 letters long, and then some message actually have probability zero, those that contain somehow 5 consonants in a row, just because you cannot even pronounce them. Some have a more probability than others, depending on the context that you already know about the situation. And so you have somehow a probability distribution about what your opponent is going to say on the message he's going to choose. But what you are after is not only necessarily just the message in its entirety, right, but you also have partial information. So what should be this partial information? You can think that it's a function mapping a message to some other smaller space, perhaps. So, for instance, you want to know, well, is the message a message concerning attack or retreat? If it is, or is the sender expressing worry? You'd like to know if your enemy is worried and is communicating this to his ally. Or things like this. So, for simplicity, assume that this function F that you want to measure from the message, if you're not able to decrypt the message, is actually maps any message into a number between 1 and 1,000, say, okay? Okay, so now you're asking the following situation. So, if somebody tells you the sender has selected a message from the message space and says, and ascended by magic, by teletransportation to its destination. So what is the function of this message? So say, you'd like to win this game, right? Somebody says, I selected a message. What is the F of this message? So how would you answer? So I'll say, well, you know what? If I'm trying to be as right as I can be, say, so what is the most popular value, most probable value for this F can take? And so somehow you say that, remember that F maps every message between a number between 1 and 1,000. So you say maybe 727 is the most popular number and it occurs with probability 2%. And that is so if you say 727, you'll be right automatically with probability 2%, right? You don't need any cryptography. You don't need to know anything. You just know that what the message space is, what the distribution is, and you choose the most popular value for F of M. Okay, so now instead the situation changes dramatically because the sender not only has chosen the message at random, but also encrypts it, transmits an encryption of it, and now you also see the encryption of this message. Not only you know that you are selected according to the right probability distribution, but here, lo and behold, you have an encryption of it. Now, can you guess what F of that message is better than before? Remember, before, without any cryptanalysis, you could be right at 2% of the time. Now, can you improve it? If you cannot improve it more than, say, 2%, not 2.01%, 2.001%, 2 plus epsilon percent, then the encryption, we call it semantic secure. Okay, that is the whole idea, but now it's computational complexity rather than information theoretical assumption that drives the notion of semantic security. Now, what we figure out is that we develop actually computational indistinguishability as a tool to prove semantic security. And we prove that if we had a system which was actually computationally indistinguishable, that implied that it was actually semantic security. And then actually we proved that the opposite was true, that semantic security improved computational indistinguishability. And there were actually other notions that we could prove to be all equivalent to each other for this notion of security. And this is the most reassuring thing that can be in science when you try to describe a new object. and you go from one avenue for another avenue, you get a third avenue, and all these avenues become absolutely equivalent. So going back to Turing, right, so at the time in which, you know, the notion of computation was up for grabs, and people were trying to figure out, okay, I understand poetry, I understand, you know, other human endeavors, but how should we define computation? And so Turing described it using Turing machines, right? Church used lambda calculus. Another definition is recursive functions. And then at some point, it turns out that all these definitions were all equivalent to one another. So one did not have to pick and choose which was the right one, because they were one and the same. And this identity is actually very reassuring that the right notion has been achieved. So all of them, so the semantic security and computation distinguishability really are the ones that, you know, somehow by being another equivalent notion, by being equivalent, provide us the best proof that somehow we got to this, what this secure encryption means. And actually, you may want to use one for meaning, like semantic security, but you want to stick, we found, to computational security when you want to prove things, because it's much simpler and so enables us to do proofs.
It's just so amazing, the level of thinking. And I can see now overall that your work, you know, the profound impact. So, and speaking about that, how do you see your work revolutionizing the study of cryptography and laying the foundation for the theory of cryptographic security?
Well, you know, so cryptography has existed since time immemorial, right? It goes back, you know, thousands of years. People want to encrypt the messages, right? But for a long time, you know, you did not design a crypto system so as to achieve a predefined rigorous goal or security. So you simply design a crypto system and which achieved whatever it achieved by definition. You tried the best you could. You tried to poke at your system best you could. And there were no proofs, right? Only heuristics. You essentially considered a laundry list of possible attacks and then checked that each one you considered so far failed. And but there was no guarantee, right, that a new yet unconsidered attack would fail too. So there was only a loose connection between the human problem of decoding and the purely mathematical problem that the cryptographer had chosen to build his crypto system. Because when you solve a mathematical problem, that is one thing. And when you try to decode, you are helped by grammar constraints, by logical constraints, by context, by a lot of other things, right? So these two problems are not quite the same. So the problem that you may chosen is the one of factoring, that is actually a great problem. Essentially means that, you know, there are numbers like primes, like 2, 3, 5, 7. But if you take two large primes, say 1,000 digits each, and you multiply them, you can still do it by pen and paper. But then once I give you the product and say, I multiply two random primes to get this number, which prime I used, then nobody knows how to factor the number, so retrieve the two primes that I use, right? In fact, actually, Gauss and plenty of other mathematicians, you know, have looked at this problem without being able to solve it. So that is a very pure mathematical problem, but has nothing to do with decoding. So, and when we used to build a crypto system based on factoring, usually we build a system in which if you knew how to factor, we knew how to decode. But this is not the interesting direction, right? The interesting direction is the other one, namely that nobody could decode messages or even gain partial information about your messages without being able to factor. So if factoring is hard, therefore, the system is absolutely unbreakable. And if somebody somehow understands what I say because he's able to solve factoring and succeed where Gauss and company failed, you know what? He deserves to understand what I'm saying. Okay? But the main idea that we did is introduce this notion of a reduction and two proofs. To prove really that a purely mathematical problem was actually absolutely identical to a very human problem, like getting partial information about what an individual has said. Essentially, we found a way to rigorously reduce apples to oranges, right? But by now, you know, we routinely design crypto systems with this notion of security embedded and all these reductions. So I believe that bringing proofs and replacing heuristics as proofs and having these very sophisticated apples to oranges reductions was actually our contribution to the field.
And what a contribution. Again, an historical inflection point, which really marks a huge shift, I think, in my opinion. So.
Oh, thanks.
Now, Silvio, can you talk more about your work with knowledge complexity and zero knowledge proofs?
Yes. So somehow, you know, proofs are supposed to convey knowledge, yes? So there is a theorem statement, and you don't know if it is true at all. So you ask somebody to prove it to you. He or she provides you a proof. And at this point, at the end of the proof, if the proof checks after you verified, you know not only that the statement as claimed is true, but you know a lot of other things. You know why it is true, right? So you must get a lot of details that allow to that you check one against the other that convinces you that the statement or the theorem is true. So instead, I want to say, well, but assume now that we want to reduce the amount of knowledge necessary to convince somebody that a theorem is true to a minimum. So what should this minimum be? Well, you know, at the end of the day, the minimum should be that you learned that the statement is true, which you didn't know beforehand, right? So, but that is what I really want to reveal in any proof. But now, to say a zero knowledge proof is a proof that reveals only that the statement is true without adding any other pieces of knowledge to it. And the question is, but how can you tell that nothing else has leaked? And in some sense, that is, again, another application of the simulation paradigm which you were discussing before. Because essentially, you wanted to prove a theorem in a way that if somebody knew beforehand that the statement of the theorem was true, then he could reconstruct the proof you give it to him in exactly the same way in which you provided it. So in other words, how do I know that from this interaction, from this big interaction, I don't learn any much more than the statement of the theorem being true? By saying that, okay, you learned that the theorem is true, I wanted to give you this. If you knew this beforehand, then there is no other further information in my proof because you can simulate the entire proof. And that is a zero knowledge proof. And then if you want to say knowledge complex, you want to say, well, sometimes you may want to do a little bit more. Think of it as an example in an election. There is no theorem here, but still there is a zero knowledge interaction. So assume that you have 100 people in a room and they want to do a very simple election, the simplest election, a referendum, okay? So what do we want to do? We want to tally our yeses and no. Each one votes for yes or no, and we want to tally how many yeses there are. And assume that there are actually 60 yeses and 40 noes. So you want to compute that there are 60 yeses and 40 noes, but you don't want to reveal who voted for what. You want to keep private the vote, but you want to evaluate, compute the tally correctly. So you want to have both correctness and privacy at the same time. Now, correctness without privacy, that's not a problem. Because all of a sudden I can just say, okay, ladies and gentlemen, whoever votes yes raises the hands, I count six hands, so there are 60 yeses in this referendum. But if I want to have privacy alone without correctness or tally at all, I can say everybody takes a yes or no or puts it in an envelope and keep it there. So then this total secrecy is easy, but then, you know, what is the result? So the idea instead is that, you know, without trusting anybody, we can compute the tally of 60 yeses in a way that we have no idea who voted yes and who voted no. Of course, if you trust somebody, you can just say, oh, just whisper in my ear what your vote is, and I promise not to tell anybody, and further, I promise to announce the correct tally. Sure, I mean, this is not going to fly with anybody, and with cryptographers in particular. So the idea is that we replace this trust in some individual to guarantee correctness and privacy simultaneously by just talking to each other and trusting, say, maybe the majority of us are honest. That is essentially the idea. Is a blending of correctness and privacy. And because correctness matters in all human enterprises, and privacy matters to all humans, I believe that is a good building block for a theory of human interaction.
And this is very interesting. So what do you see as the implications of this work, and how does the work extend to other domains?
All right, so the implication. So another domain. So the implication, you know, first of all, you can imagine that in a cryptographic protocol, in an economic transaction, you want to have, you know, both correctness and secrecy. So let me give you an example. So assume that you go to a carpet store, right? And you see a carpet there. As it happens in such stores, you don't have a price tag with a carpet. So you say, I'm interested in this carpet. How much does it cost? And the other guy says, well, wait a second, how much you are willing to offer? You say, no, you go first, right? This is very complicated. So assume instead that helps us to generate a new transaction that we didn't quite have before, such as the following. Say, assume that we engage in a cryptographic protocol in which I find the buyer, I put as an input to my protocol the maximum buying price I may have, and you as the seller put the minimum selling price you may consider. And now, through a protocol, without telling each other these two values, we just simply compare them. And if there is no overlap, so if the maximum buying price is below the minimum selling price, we only learn, sorry guys, you, the two of you cannot transact, no carpet sale today. Or we end up with, if there is an overlap, say we end up with a digitally signed contract by both of us that the carpet is sold and is now mine at a price, say, split in the middle between the minimum buying price and the maximum buying price, or whatever we want it to be. So that is something that, you know, somehow enlarges the realm of possibilities that you have in a paper world, a regular world transaction. So the implication could also be, in my opinion, independent of business transactions, that is actually an enabler of secure interactions, enables more interaction. So let me give you another example. Assume now we have a dating game, okay? There are two individuals and I go first and say, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, I like you 10. How much do you like me? And the answer comes back, 2. Then I get an heart attack and I never interact with anybody in the real future because I have to recover, okay? But assume now that you can actually have another transaction in which you can somehow compare these two numbers and figure out the two of you like each other both at 10 or the two of you don't like each other both at 10. So then, you know, I have much less to lose in self-image and am I actually enable to have, you know, much more transactions like this. So if I can control the amount of privacy that I lose, and I can confidently enter into many more transactions than before. So I think that this is one implication, is that it's an enabler not only of business transactions, but actual of personal transactions as well. And you ask, you know, other domains. Well, essentially, now, other domains, there are plenty of other domains, because essentially, at this point, from just encryption, cryptography has become a science of adversarial computing. And adversaries are everywhere, as everybody knows, not only cryptographers. In a proof of adversary is whoever wants to convince you of a false statement. In an encryption of adversary is somebody who wants to understand information about your messages. Right, in pseudo random number generation, the adversary is somebody who wants to you to choose biased rather than unbiased coins, et cetera. So in other words, you know, when you want to model a very complex system, the best way to model a complex system is to model it adversarially. Because the more complex the system is, the more it looks like that there is really an evil guy there trying to wreck the apart, right, to make sure that nothing works. So essentially this theory is becoming an actually really hand in glove with fault tolerant computing, where you really want to make sure that, you know, a network of computers continue to work properly together, even though some of them fail and fail in a way that resembles totally adversarial actions. It has enlarged to encompass, you know, pseudo-random number generation. It has provided the bounds of what is learnable. You know, Valiant and Kearns somehow have used, you know, Shafi and my resultant together with Odette Goldreich on pseudo-random function to figure out what is that cannot be efficiently learned. So it has, because adversarial computing is so pervasive and allows us to model so many things, there are many, many domains to which this work may apply.
I see. That's fascinating. So I can see this now in 10 years' time, a Nobel Prize.
Thanks. I don't know about that, but thanks.
Now, you've somewhat addressed this in all the different kinds of answers you've provided in this dialogue we've had so far, but maybe you can sort of overview then. How does your work address important practical problems such as the protection of data from being viewed or modified and providing a secure means of communication and transactions over the Internet?
All right, yes, sure. Now, encryption is not the only thing that you want to do over the Internet. You know, somehow protection of data from being viewed we discussed, but from being modified we have not yet discussed, right? So for instance, from protection that have been modified, Shafi and Ron Rivest, right, my colleague at MIT and prior Turing Award winner, and I developed a digital signature scheme that actually has set the standards for subsequent ones in the forum digital signatures. Okay, so can I describe briefly what this involves? Let me go on a limb and take another 5 minutes. So essentially, what is a digital scheme, right? Is a digital signature scheme involves a pair of matching keys, a secret key that allows me to sign messages, and a public key that enables everyone to verify the messages I sign using my first key. So the crucial property is that the public verification key does not betray the secret signing key. That is, knowledge of a verification key should not enable one to compute the signing key in any remotely feasible time, such as a few million years, right? Even with the fastest computer. So to prove that a given message M comes from me, I use my secret key, signing key, to compute a short string S, that my digital signature of a message, that indeed depends on M, right? Because different M's would have a different digital signature from me. But then you can use my signature S and M and my public verification key to see if S is indeed the correct signature of mine of a message. That means to rest assured that I consented to the message M, okay? Now, for this to work, it is necessary that these signatures are how unforgeable for somebody else. Okay, but what does this mean? You know, in the past means that an adversary could not come in, look at my public verification key, and forge my signature of his favorite message, such as, you know, Silvio owns me $1 million, say, right? But somehow we need to more security than that somebody from scratch cannot forge his favorite messages pretending that I sign it. So what do we need? We need, for instance, that somebody cannot modify a prior signature of mine to forge my signature on a modified message. So for instance, if I indeed sign I, Silvio, owe you, Stephen, $1,000, somebody should not be able to change it into I owed Stephen or somebody else $2,000, right? So even a slight modification you want to. Even more, you want that somebody cannot ask me to sign a few things, and assuming that I do agree and sign them, he should not learn how to sign. So think of a notary public, right? A notary public essentially is somebody who signs messages chosen by other people. And of course, he could use digital signatures to digitally signed messages. So somebody says, okay, I don't know how to forge a signature of this notary public, but I'm asking, do you mind please sign the following message? And he does. Then he says, oh, that's interesting. Now I learned something that I didn't know before. I think I start getting the idea how the signature of this notary public looks like. But I'm not quite sure. So let me ask a second question. Could you please sign the second message? And the notary public signs it again. Say, oh, gee, now I'm getting the gist of it. And so I go on with this for this process a bunch of times. I request signatures. The guy agrees and signs them back. But then I want that I cannot sign anything, any new message at all. So I want that signatures not only are unforgeable from scratch, but remain unforgeable because they cannot be learned at all. So when I arrived in this country, in some sense, you know, English was a crypto system for me, right? I could not really be understood by anybody, more or less. But I was able to ask questions, so how do you say this, how do you say that, and slowly, slowly, I learn enough to get by. So we don't want in a digital signature scheme that this happens. So we want a more stringent notion of security. We want signatures which are unlearnable, and that is, I believe that this is crucial if you really want to have a theory of things that cannot be modified over the internet, and these actually, we do have a signature scheme with this property developed already.
Now, what is the impact of your work on computational complexity?
Well, you know, interactive proofs, which is were crucial to understanding which class of problems admit efficient proofs. So I would say certainly that, right? So remember that, you know, proving a theorem is the most frustrating things. They are frustrating to write down with proofs. They are frustrating to read them. And somehow interactive proofs, actually, they transform this frustrating thing into a game between a prover and a verifier. And somehow, if the theorem is true and I act as a prover, then I should win a very simple game between you and me, in which the game has, say, five moves. I move, you move, I move, you move. And one of us wins, and we can determine, we see who wins. So, and I tell you, so if the theorem is true, then I should win all the time. If the theorem is false, I should win at most half of the time. So if we very fast interact, say, 100 times, and you see that I win 100 times in a row, you conclude, well, you know what, that's the best explanation is that the theorem is actually true. And then, therefore, this is important in complexity theory because you want to figure out which problems are efficiently provable and which are not. So interactive proofs are really one of the impact of this work on complexity theory. For another example, you know, my work on pseudo randomness with Blum first and with Shafi and Oded later, essentially has helped us understand which problem can be solved deterministically. So somehow we know that by now, thanks to the work of Solveig Strassen and Rabin, that there are problems which can actually be solved probabilistically. But then what happens if you don't have coins to flip? And so somehow this pseudo-random number generation, the theory of it allows us to say something about what can be solved deterministically. But more in general, a lot of my work depends on a one-way function, okay? So a one-way function is a function that has two key components, very antagonistic to each other. The first component is that the function f is easy to evaluate, which means on input x, you can compute f of x very, very quickly. However, the function is hard to invert, meaning that given f of x, you have no idea how to retrieve one such x. So essentially, that is the mathematical analog of the one-way phenomenon that we so commonly experience in the real world, right? So, for instance, if I take a glass and I smash it on the floor, that is very easy. But to reconstitute the original glass is much harder. So it's a one-way phenomenon. As for another example, even harder than the other one, it's easy to scramble an egg, yes, but to unscramble is a totally different story. So this one-way function essentially incorporate in the same object both easy and hard computation. And thus it's not surprising that understanding one-way function increases our understanding of complexity theory, which is the field devoted to figure out which problems are easy to solve and which ones are not.
You know, it's fascinating. How do you, or what are your thoughts about things like, you know, and quantum mechanics and the twin particle effect and sort of the impact that's going to have perhaps on your field, or you see sort of the work of duty of peril and causality and counterfactuals and external validity in artificial intelligence. Do you see some kind of connection between some of the research you've done and those areas at all?
Well, certainly let me address the one which about a more dangerous to my field, of, which is, you know, quantum computing. So we need hard problems to base cryptography on. In fact, actually, as we said, we want to take a purely computational problem, purely mathematical problem, and actually use it to massage it around and transform it by magic in a very human problem, like this message comes from Stephen or whatever, right? So of course, what is easy computation and what is hard computation depends a lot on computational model. If you have an abacus, what is hard and what is easy is one thing. If you have now a modern computer, is something else, but still a classical computer. If you have now a quantum computer, it may actually vary. The judge is still out whether it really helps to speed up computation or not, but it might. So first of all, a theory of what is easy and hard is, at most we have to redefine what is easy and what is hard when you want to have, you know, a one-way function that is one way for a quantum computer, not for a digital computer. So you, the examples, specific examples that we may have, such as factoring, may disappear, but this does not mean that we cannot generate other examples, because essentially we have now a very general theory that, one-way computation that I don't see why it cannot be lifted to another computational platform such as quantum computing.
You know, there amongst our listeners, there's people who are not necessarily heavily involved now in the technical aspects, and in some ways they could be consumers because they're in senior management now, and you know their technical years are long past. So, what are the practical implications and applications of your work influencing all of our daily lives?
All right, so if I choose, you know, the simple example is that one of a password, right, that I'm sure that everybody has dealt with, right? So a password, again, is something that has used to be the same from thousands of years. Essentially, is some magic secret phrase somehow that, say, abracadabra, right, that I use to enter say a castle. If I'm a medieval knight and I am on the other side of a moat and I see the bridge is drawn and I want it to be lowered, I say to the guard upstairs, abracadabra, and recognizing the password, the guard lowers the bridge and I can come in. And essentially this continues to be the same. You can use your mother maiden name, I can use my favorite uncle, but it still is one secret number that we actually use to communicate. Now, this system, of course, has some drawbacks, right? Essentially, if in the moat of the castle there is under the water there somebody who just listened to what the knight whispers before getting into the castle, he will learn abracadabra. Next time, you know, he impersonates the knight, he puts a helm and armor and says abracadabra, and the bridge will be lowered for him too. And in addition, a classical password system is that, you know, the gatekeeper himself knows now the password. So if I use the same password, say not only to enter the castle, but also to log in at MIT in the morning, or to log in to my bank site and withdraw or wire money out of it. So, and that is a very dangerous thing, because I'm actually am enabling any verifier of these two systems to impersonate me to the other system. Okay, so, but now instead, what do we get to do? Assume that I generate somehow a theorem whose proof only I know. For instance, I take three large random primes and I multiply them together, and then I tell MIT, the castle, my bank, and to say, this number here, blah, 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 is Silvio's number. Anybody who proves to you that is product of three prime, let me mess around with my account, let me wire money on my behalf, let me erase papers at MIT, that's me. And I consent to that. Okay, so now, if you remember, we discussed about zero-knowledge proofs. Somehow, when I want to log in, I engage with MIT computer server, say, with, you know, a zero-knowledge proof that Silvio's number is product of three primes that can be verified by everybody, but is a zero-knowledge proof. So in particular, nobody having verified is able to prove it to to anybody else. Because remember, a zero-knowledge proof is tantamount to say, this number is product of three primes. So if he tries to impersonate me to my bank, say, the MIT server are going to say, this is Silvio and this number is product of three primes. Yeah, so prove it to me. Well, oops, I don't know, right? Because in a zero-knowledge proof, you don't learn how to prove things. You only learn that the statement is true. So suddenly, you have essentially a very ideal password system. Very efficient that you can implement with smart cards, and that would be the most practical application that I can think of.
Silvio, you're this giant in industry and education and research and so on, and your work resonates throughout the world. And so I know our audience would be interested if you can additionally profile your extensive research history, their lasting impact, and some valuable lessons you wish to share from each of your top research areas that we haven't talked about yet.
All right. So first of all, let me actually just mention, rather than profiling additional field of research, I've been working on distributed computing in addition to whatever we just discussed, on private information retrieval, etc. But perhaps, you know, we should move on from the technical work. So for lessons, the most valuable lesson that I found for me, and certainly and we work for many other people that I can think of, is really generalize and simplify as much as you want the concrete examples that motivate you. Right? Concrete examples are wonderful. They really drive us, but also they are typically messy, right? They contain, you know, an abundance of details that may actually blind us. So my lesson would be just, you know, get rid of all details as much as possible. Generalize your problem as much as possible. Back up and back farther up until you see the whole picture in its simplicity. So generalize a problem until it becomes either impossible or very simple to solve. So by backing up, you get the full view and drive yourself to a corner. And once you have no escape, you may lose, but you may also find additional strength and win big. And at the end of the day, who needs a partial victory? So my lesson would be drive yourself to the corner and go from there.
Well, that's an interesting concept. So how many times have you done that?
Oh, I've done it as a graduate student. I've done it when an undergraduate student. I've done it as an assistant professor. I've done it a few times. So the amazing thing is that somehow it may work. So I'm not preaching without the practicing, let's put it this way.
Now, it seems to me that concept could be applied to so many other areas, perhaps friends and family and business deals in it as well.
At the end, no, why not? Never sit at a negotiating table that you cannot get up and leave at any time. And never shoot for enough friendship. You know, sometimes I think it's worth to risk it all.
I see, Silvio. So this could be a book beyond your research that the general public will read.
I'm sure I'm not alone, right? I mean, I'm sure there's many people would agree with me.
Now, Silvio, you talked about your past research, and you also talked about some of the other areas that you have researched. Can you get into more detail about your current research interests?
Yes, somehow at a late age, unfortunately, I come up with a beautiful notion that was put forward somehow half a century ago by economists, which is mechanism design. And essentially, this is a way to take to choose an optimal outcome without the data. So somehow optimizing is never easy, even if you have the data. But if you don't have the data, it becomes actually much harder. And so why do you don't have the data? Because, you know, other people, somehow the players have the data. And say, why can't you just ask them? Well, because they may have a stake in the outcome you choose. So, and having a stake, therefore, when you ask what the data is, they may have a strategic incentive to lie so as to manipulate the outcome you choose in their favor. And so you must figure out essentially to engineer a game that everybody wants to play, so to maximize his own utility, so to play to, in his own interest only, and you choose the game such that as a side product of the game, you actually learn which decisions you should take. It's a fascinating field, and that's what I'm currently working on, from my own special perspective, of course.
And then what are the broad implications and applications of this work?
Well, you know, in principle, you know, any decision maker, in particular any politician, right, would stand to benefit from mechanism design. So that is should be immediate. If you really want to go one step farther, that may be the best way to engineer systems like the internet, that they are very decentralized, in which no one is in charge. And because no one is in charge, right, you can put all the rules and laws that you want, right, but unless you make it, you design the system that everybody's incentivized to stick by the rules, the system will never quite work in the end. So it may actually be used in engineering of large decentralized systems too. And finally, you know, I'll not be surprised if mechanism design were to provide us with key insights for understanding existing and successful biological systems, right? Perhaps, you know, complex organisms are not just, you know, I don't know, the visible product of some unlikely kind of equilibrium, very fragile thing, but actually they are the robust outcome of a properly or slowly designed mechanism.
Ah, fascinating. And again, I mentioned Michi, maybe in the Nobel Prize as well.
Ay, ay, ay.
Now, what are your future research interests?
Okay, so if you stress future, the answer is the brain. But it's a future interest, and yes, the brain will be my future interest. But, and not only mine, in fact, other computer scientists in particular, Les Valiant before me have started working on it. I think that I'm considering working on that.
Now, that's fascinating. In terms of that work, you're thinking of applying sort of a mathematical model to it, or getting in more sort of into the engineering side, or getting into sort of, you know, the works like external validity or causation and some of that area. Sort of what's the approach?
You know, remember that I truthfully answered your question by saying stressing future. So right now, we don't know, at least I don't know which angle is going to be, but certainly it's going to be much more of a computation point of view, right? So there is, I believe that at the end, you know, big part of the brain should be modeled as a computer, and memory in particular, and you want to put things into memory and retrieve them efficiently and with some redundancies. And, you know, we know a lot of how to store, retrieve, and manipulate information when we have a total liberty to decide the components. Here, the components are drawn beforehand, but perhaps some of the lessons we learn from distributed computing may be applicable to the brain, too. More than this, I do not know. Right now, I'm working on mechanism design, as I was saying.
It's interesting, the whole concept of that kind of research, and I'm thinking of Daniel Dennett and the consciousness explained, or Descartes, and sort of this mind-body. You know, is there a mind-body connection, or Penrose and some of the work that he's done in thinking about the brain, but from a more of a philosophical sense, or Kurzweil and this idea of a singularity, which in some circles is controversial. Do you have any feelings about that sort of idea, about a soul and a brain, and is there something more that we don't understand?
We don't understand a lot, but I think that if you ask me, remember, you know, whatever I said about, you know, the simulation paradigm, never mind the mind and body. Really, the question here really is whether the whole universe can fit in the brain, right? I mean, I am a little bit of an extremist on this point of view. But again, so there are tremendous possibilities there, and but I have not given them the rigorous thought that I given to some other fields yet.
Silvio, I could just see those roots of this kind of thinking going back to when you were a child and talking to your mother. Now, what are your most difficult challenges in research, and what valuable lessons do you wish to share?
Well, my challenges, if I to be frank, are the inability to work alone and lack of knowledge. And so the lesson I'll share are the same one that I used to cope with my challenges, collaboration and imagination. So what if you cannot work alone, right? You can always collaborate, but provided it is important that you hold on to your own individual obsession, no matter how much extensively you collaborate. And again, so what, who cares if your arsenal is quite small? Be imaginative, forge your own tool, and march ahead.
Now, every time you get researchers together, or you get, I guess, any group or cohort together, you're going to get a lot of discussion, you're going to get debate, you're going to get some collaboration, you're going to get different points of view. So what would you describe as additional areas of controversy in the areas that you research?
Well, controversy is everything is controversial. In fact, actually, I think the main controversy that I can, not only in my research area, but you know, in any area, is the very definition of an area. Right? That is the most contentious item in research. So, to be clear, I mean, defining an area is both necessary and useful to focus the effort of future work, to flush out the problems, to attract fresh mind, et cetera, et cetera. But it's also a constraint, it's a boundary, right? And boundaries may always incarcerate us. So we have to be very, very, very careful. So our theoretical community is just amazing. I really love my community. And so it is invaded in our new territories with determination, even a ferocity, and a cleverness, you know, which, you know, like a bunch of conquistadores, but fortunately with no physical bloodshed. But even we, such a progressive and ready to abandon all boundaries, society, we risk to transform ourselves into the guardians of the sacred fire, right? With very great speed. And then we start fighting to protect the purity of our field against outside contamination. I mean, this is mind-boggling to me, right? Because suddenly the game is not to find solution to problems which do not exist, but to solve older problems. And the older, the better, because you get more credit for solving, you know, a 50-year-old problem than you get to solve a 10-year-old problem, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you know, you need to solve and pose and solve new problems to solve old problems, but I don't understand the emphasis on old problems, right? And that is really a disease, because finally, if you chair a prestigious conference or you are the editor-in-chief of a flagship journal, somehow you start feeling that you are expected to become a businessman, to satisfy customers, the customers who put you there. So if you publish outlandish material, the number of subscribers may drop in protest. How do you look? Right? Can you accept this damage to your reputation? You know, publishing such material may cost you further advancement. On the other hand, refusing to publish as a dangerous new material is by definition hidden from the public eye. So you may actually harm the growth of your field, but no one will ever know. So I'm actually saddened by the fact that journals and conferences publish a disproportionate amount of small but declared big advances on the status quo. I believe that the incentives are misplaced, and we can and must do better and never define too strict a way any area.
That's quite fascinating what you just stated there. I mean, it kind of reminds me of this idea of disruptive innovation or research, and this concept of a innovator's DNA platform, where they sort of modeled, you know, what creates breakthrough innovation, what creates breakthrough disruptive innovation. They find these are sort of these five qualities, one of which is always actively questioning everybody, everything and everybody, always actively observing everything and everybody, always actively experimenting in diverse areas, even across areas that are outside of your domain, to get a different perspective. And the final two elements are associating, and that is synthesizing all the kind of different concepts in all the different areas, and integrating that information as you sort of proceed day to day. And then finally, networking with others, but particularly those who hold diverse views and perhaps contradictory views, or even to views to the point where it could break the system, or close to, you know, sort of your collaborative team. It sounds like you're sort of speaking to that, not to get into this sort of group think idea.
Absolutely. So, of course, there is the risk that, you know, if everything is innovates continuously so fast, then we cannot discern anything anymore. We need some rigidity. I don't know, you know, it's an old question of whether a geometry could be invented if we were a water animal. I mean, we need we need some solid terrain, perhaps, to hypothesize, you know, a triangle and so on and so forth. Maybe not. But what I'm saying is that we must, however, do better than just barring this. We must have, it would be nice if every journal has a conference, has actually accepts, say, 10 articles. You have two, the oddball articles, in which, you know, you put something out there which actually people expected, and I bet that they will be read with interest, and they're going to go even simple things like this a long way to incentivate, you know, us to question ourselves and our own fields and to make progress.
I see. So actively embrace outliers.
Yes, yes. Bring them into the fold. We need the outliers. But we also need, you know, to make progress on the established questions. So we need both, right? So, and my problem is that I perceive that, you know, is a disproportionate emphasis on the traditional work. So, of course, innovation breaks through once in a while, but not at the rate we can actually control and optimize the rate a bit. Actually quite a bit.
Now, Silvio, can you describe the types of research being created or updated that will drive our experiences in 5 or 10 years? And what will this experience be like? Can you paint a picture for our audience?
Well, frankly, my prediction for future research can only be based on what I know. So I expect now more and better of the same. Okay, so I don't know how interesting that may be. So all expert predictions matter less than the development we cannot predict. I mean, if our predictions were exact, our future would be doomed to boredom and missed opportunity. I personally look forward to major surprises, and I must confess that those I cannot anticipate.
Now, you have this remarkable background, your educational background, that is, at the University of Rome and in Berkeley. So what specific challenges in your education at these two famous institutions were catalysts to inflection points in your lifetime of contributions, and how and why did this happen?
Oh, wow. That is, thanks for asking. So that is, really, I really like to give, credit, to this, great educational systems, both of them, both in Rome and in Berkeley, and the people actually behind them. And they really shaped me. So, let me have a crack at, explaining, all this, right? So first of all, you know, both universities, and in particular the specific teachers I had in them have been very flexible. And this for me really shaped my attitude towards research. In the United States, tell you the truth, a course is run more tightly than in Italy. And as a student, you are monitored continuously with your problem sets. And then the exam is, so to speak, the last day of the course. There is no room for negotiations of alternative dates very much. In the Italian system, instead, you are much more in charge of yourself. There are lectures, of course, there are sessions of exercises, but it's totally up to you to attend or not to attend. And the exam, you can actually take it when you feel ready, after a month, after a few months, after a year, even. Right? So that, for me, was really ideal, because I could not function otherwise. So typically I took, you know, 4 year-long courses, which year-long is still means from November to May. Then I took, say, one exam in June, another in July, say, one in September, one in October, and then courses started again. Okay, so that for me was being able to be tested when I felt that I was ready. It was, you know, because I absorb things slowly. And that was, you know, extremely important to me. Now, people-wise, I really, really admire and I own a lot to this Professor Luciano De Vito. He taught us analysis. You must know that I came in a typical Italian fashion from a classical high school. So lots of humanities, history, philosophy, and very little math. In fact, the only math that I was exposed to was Euclidean geometry, and maybe because it was Greek. Okay, so I was fascinated by it enough to decide to go to physics. So I started in physics, and so I was taking for the first time, you know, analysis, and it's a marvelous, you know, field for those, you know, you start talking about the infinity in rigorous terms, was wonderful. But whatever made this course unique, as I realized later, was that this guy, De Vito, organized the entire course about problems. He never gave us definition, theorem, proof. He says, what is area? And then unleashed a big debate of what area might be. Or then problems that you cannot solve, you know, right away, but we solve, you know, very much later. The problems were really center stage. And we were obliged, actually, to define things if we want to make progress. And somehow, for instance, this ability or necessity to define things is something that really helped me tremendously in my future. So I had there an entire course devoted to do research, and that was the first course that I ever took. Okay. So at some point in time, you know, I really loved this so much. He says, who cares about physics? Actually, what I care is about mathematics. I understood the mathematics to be analysis. So I said, you know, Professor De Vito, I really want to switch to mathematics. To my surprise, the guy says, no. So he can't, you cannot switch. So why not? Because he says he's proud to be an analyst himself, but somehow that is for older people like him, and a young person like me should not do it, and I'm better off staying in physics. Okay, so, you know, I actually, for once, I followed his advice. And I said, perhaps I could have it change his mind if I actually prove something. And so this guy actually mentioned one problem, which was a technical problem to find, you know, a set non-measurable according to Lebesgue. Never mind, it was something which I was unprepared for, and somehow I decided to solve it. And I could not solve it, at least not right away. So I totally obsessed about it to the point that I actually neglected to follow his lectures. I was behind in the course. I dropped all the other courses. But towards the end, somehow I managed to solve it, and I presented to him his solution. He was very happy. So all of a sudden, you know, I am in the second year, and I solved this problem and didn't much else. And I decided whether, you know, given I can take exams whenever I wanted, to say, let me have a look at the first exams. Session of exams to see that when I'm actually prepared for the material, which was a multivariate calculus at that point, I actually know what is going on. And, you know, those exams are different than in the States. They're all exams to begin with. There is a roll call. You are asked, you go to this desk in isolation, examined by three professors at a time, say a chair professor and two assistants, and they are quizzed about, you know, everything, and everybody else, you know, stands around the watch. And to my surprise, this guy actually called me. I wasn't even enrolled, and asked me about, you know, Lebesgue theory, and asked me about my contrasample, and then gave me an A+. I mean, for me, that was really a transformative experience. Somehow I got the notion that it was okay to carve a path on my own, and that I would be accepted by some, and that, you know, somehow that researcher has to be center stage. You know, I really felt, you know, empowered somehow in a way. So at this point, however, this was election two. And the second thing that I actually asked him and says, you know what, you know, I think that, you know, thank you for suggesting to stick to physics, but I really want to do mathematics. And this time he gave me permission to switch to mathematics, but he says never analysis. And he says, if you really want to do mathematics, what you have to do is, he didn't use the word, but he was describing, you know, essentially theoretical computer science. He told me about the Gödel. He told me about Turing. He told me about the result. But then he also had the wording, says, you know, you really watch out, because to do this stuff, you need a lot of stomach. So somehow I switched to mathematics, but I neglected his advice and continued to follow instead courses in analysis. But on the fourth year, I paid attention to what he said enough to follow informally as a listener two courses, one in Lambda Calculus with Corrado Bem, which was actually and still is the father of Italian informatics, I mean Italian computer science, and one in Logic with Giuseppe Jacopini. Corrado has always been very enthusiastic. He sought me out. He convinced to leave analysis, to actually enroll in his class, and he gave me a challenge. He says, you know, why don't you stay in the class, and why don't you try to prove that? And that challenge then became my senior thesis and our first paper. So now, at this point, I tell you the truth, I was convinced that I wanted to do computer science, but was at the end of my preparation, and I was totally unprepared. In Italy at that time, there was not a graduate program. Now there is, but not at that time. So Corrado, quite unselfishly, suggested that I actually pursue a doctoral degree in CS abroad, but I wasn't yet sure. But there was a summer course, 1 month intense course for mathematics and computer science, so to speak. And the idea was that you choose four courses out of some eight, and I chose four, and then I liked two, and again, true to myself, I dropped the other, and I only follow the two that I liked, and I said at the end, these guys don't give any degrees, why not? I even less risk than before. And one of these courses was on graph algorithm, and it was taught by Shimon Eden. Shimon was a wonderful teacher from the Technion in Israel, and so he really introduced me to algorithmic thinking, and he became a beloved friend and a real mentor. And the second course was also on algorithm, a bit more general algorithm, and was taught by Fabrizio Lucio from Pisa. So at the end, you know, they actually gave me the same advice than Corrado. They all say, I think you have to go abroad. And somehow, all three of them suggested, you know, Berkeley as the more suitable place for me to study. So I applied. I actually was admitted and eventually went. And I must tell you, that was another lesson for me. So, you know, to see these people who actually advised me to go, advise somebody who has nothing to do, was not even a formerly one of their students, they advised me to go somewhere else to complete my study. So somehow gave me the impression that research really was an enterprise without borders, I was helped from people who owe me nothing, and they really told me to go so far in a way. So in some, I realized that, you know, I was entering really a community of the mind without borders, and that people actually cared out there to advance science with a capital S. It was an amazing message, right? I was saying that I was studying history in high school, but my history books were de facto centered on the history of national states, right? Or at least I read the books that way. So the fact that there was a parallel, in fact, actually a transversal universe, somehow I didn't took notice, right? I mean, it's not, you know, I knew that science was a big enterprise on paper, right? You know, Archimedes and Eratosthenes exchange letters, Pythagoras travel all over the Mediterranean, this medieval scholar moved from Bologna, Prague, to Paris, et cetera, et cetera. You know, whatever, artists, you know, were born in one city, lived in another, worked in another, and died in another yet. So, it was really, all this I knew, but somehow I never saw it, right? So from that point on, I must tell you that geopolitical boundary faded in the background somehow forever. And so that's it. I got with this mythical view of what science ought to be and decided, yes, I will go to Berkeley. So now go to Berkeley. I was admitted, but not right away. My score on the test of English as a foreign language was actually abysmally low. So I had to take it again. So finally, I got a barely decent score, and I could begin, it was, I think, March 1979 at Berkeley. And I was utterly miserable. First of all, I realized that my English was really poor, and I could not communicate with no one, I knew no one, and I had no prerequisites in computer science. So, and there was a very tough prerequisites tree. So the courses, the only course I could take was a CS1, the name says it all, which was an entry programming courses attended by 18 and old people and even precocious younger people. So I was 25, so there was very little mingling there. So so the other courses were equally elementary. So I, bottom line, I decided I finish the trimester, I pack up, and I go back home. Kind of says, okay, I might as well enjoy the city. Just when I lowered my guard, perhaps I was a bit more open, I actually met David Lichtenstein, that at that time was a PhD student about to graduate. He took me under his wing, really, and it was another marvelous example of all the help that had been showered really over the years. He showed me around San Francisco. He told me about, forget about prerequisites. I think you need to do research, and then, why don't you pick up on all along what you need? Don't you have a math degree after all? So he told me that actually Professor Blum was finishing chairing the department of CS at Berkeley that summer. And he said, he's a great advisor, and you are lucky because he has not taken new students during his chairmanship. So in the fall, when he steps down, you would need new students. So why don't you propose yourself? So I said, I will try. I said, oh, yeah, you should try. And, that's actually is also another reason that he had in favor of Manuel, but he was from Caracas, so he spoke Spanish. So, he can understand your Italian, okay? Because apparently my English wasn't good enough. So I went to see him. Manuel was very kind, and he said, however, that, it really was, his hands were full, and we should reconsider everything in the fall, and we should wait. Now, but David, didn't give up. He was determined that I started doing research to stay motivated. And so he told me about the problem of another graduate student who just graduated with a superb thesis, Mike Sipser, now a leading complexity theorist, and in fact, the chair of MIT math department. So in his thesis, Mike had left an open problem, and David suggested that I should try to solve it. The problem was in automata theory, which of course I knew nothing about it. So he said, no problem. So I'll give you a crash course of it. So the course was, took, 2 hours or maybe 3, at a coffee shop in Berkeley. So we were sitting there, sipping cappuccinos, and he was, telling me one definition, giving a small exercise. He was testing my understanding and so on and so forth. And at the end, with the last cappuccino, I call it the 4 cappuccino courses. That's how many cappuccinos I was able to drink in one session. And he says, okay, now here is the problem that you should try to solve. So a few days later, I was actually able to solve it. So I told David, and he says, that's wonderful. Now I have to go back to Manuel and explain it. So, but Manuel said, his hands are foolish. Never mind, Manuel knows the problem. In fact, he was the advisor of Mike, so he would like to see the solution. So I went to Manuel, and David was right. Manuel wanted to hear the problem right away, clear his schedule, clear the board, and let him explain the problem. And at that point, he agreed to pick me up as a student. And from that point on, really only spoke research. I mean, I never seen somebody so research-oriented as Manuel. He really was wonderful. So at this point, I decided to stay in Berkeley. So I showed up again in the fall, and then Mike and David actually were no longer there. They already went off to their job, but that's where I met Shafi. And actually, Vijay Vadzirani too, and Mike Luby, a group of extraordinary researchers and great people, as they turned out to be. And we formed a gang of sorts, and we dine out with modest finances, but still enjoy the food, working together, and actually trying to solve the problem sets together. It was really wonderful. So in one course of Dick Cart, which was to be tested somehow, the flexibility of Berkeley, and despite being a U.S. university. So Dick Cart is a fabulous teacher too, and he had a famous algorithm class. And he mentioned a problem, fortunately and unfortunately, kind of early on in the course, and that was a problem in algorithmic graph theory, the same thing that Shimon made me enthusiastic about. And the problem was extending the running time of the best-known algorithm for matching from bipartite graphs, which is a special type of graph, to general graphs. So Vijay and I decided to work together to try to solve the problem. Somehow you know, we spend hours together. Vijay was capable of satisfying all the other courses, the other problem sets. Instead, I, again, dropped out of any courses, including the one of Descartes. I only spoke to Vijay. But at the end, by our good fortune, by the end of the course, I found a solution, right? And that solution, by the way, continues to be, to this very day, the most efficient solution for general graphs, at least. For special classes of graphs, there are better solutions by now. So now what do I do? Now, Dick, I must say to his honor, let me pass the course, which by any standard I should have failed, with a B minus. I mean, Dick is a very generous and fair person. I'm sure I must have tested his patience, his patience at his utmost. But at some point in time, you know, he had to give him a B minus. And now he was a little bit in trouble because... surviving as a PhD student with only a course and a B minus on my transcript was no joke. To make things worse, I had to pass, you know, a barrier to continue the PhD program, which was the prelim exam. And having not taken any hardware classes, I failed the hardware portion of this exam. So Dick Emanuel had to personally testify in front of a relevant committee so that I could continue my doctorate. And somehow they were very persuasive, so I was allowed to continue. And then our gang attended Manuel's course on computational number theory, and we all had a great time. We cemented our friendship, and at that point, Shafi and I joined forces on cryptography for many, many years. And she actually had a tremendous influence on me in many ways. In particular, she convinced me that given that nothing came easy to me, I might as well focus on other things only. And I must say that, you know, her insight, personal and scientific, really... spurred me on with decades of joint work, and I was indeed very fortunate to join forces with a scientist and a friend of that caliber. So at this point, I had a course that I love, taken from Manuel, companionship from great friends and researcher. The people were much more flexible than the systems, and I really felt, you know, I really was in the type of crowd. Manuel, I don't know if you know him, but he's at heart a permanent revolutionary. And then Descartes, we already spoke about, and then there was also another faculty member at the time, Andrew Yao, who started also as a physicist, but not like me, a real one, with a PhD, a postdoctorate, etc. And then he was fascinated by computation, and he switched to computer science and was then a professor at Berkeley, too. And I'm glad he was, because Shafi and he actually had a marvelous and fruitful interaction. And all these guys were actually marvelous teachers, but in very different ways. I mean, the fondest memory, such high standard to live by, is scary, really. Manuel, I don't know, he was a magician. He could, he did not explain the theorem, right? He actually forced you, actually all of the students, to prove the theorem on the spot. The trials, errors, anxiety, heartbeats, accelerations, the whole shebang of what happens when you try to solve a problem. Dick was the most clear, organized, perfect sense of timing. I mean, I have a terrible memory, whatever he explained, I still remember. And Andy, he was not formally one of my professors, but I attended all of his lectures that he gave, and two of them really changed my life. You know, one was on Shamir secret sharing when I was a student, and another one when I was an assistant professor at MIT. He was a lecturer on what he came to be known as a Yao's garbled circuit, which was had also a tremendous influence not only on the field but on me in particular. So in some sense, you know, I really think that somehow this flexibility and this focus on research and the ability to pardon, you know, to allow for cutting corners, provided that you actually strive forward at least in one direction, was really what made me what I really am, right? And in particular, I really felt I was, you know,
in a magical place. You know, remember, you know, I had a very Europe center point of view, right? To me, I really remember Berkeley was on the far edge of a civilized universe in front of the Pacific Ocean, this mythical barrier to mankind, right? I felt I was in heaven, but keeping with the metaphor, I felt that who could live in such a small city except, you know, monks? I saw them as monks, Manuel, Dick, Andy, and to this remote hermitage at the confine of Earth. But somehow it's hard to repeat such experience. You know, I learned so much. The first thing I want to learn, by the way, is that finally I learned I was not alone. I learned that science really had power to understand anything, even things that seem to be impenetrable to quantification or rational analysis altogether. I learned the power of interaction. I never forgotten. I learned that, you know, experiences that cannot be written down or repeated in any way like this that I just described are really the more permanent and precious. I ever since I became a very big fan of the oral tradition, and somehow we should protect it. It is the strongest, most sacred oral tradition we have.
Silvio, that's just an amazing history in terms of the mentors that you've had and continue to have, the collaboration with so many people, as you indicated, the flexibility that you were given. And I guess now that's generated some questions in my mind. You had this very unique kind of program, both at the University of Rome and at Berkeley, where people have given you some agility and some, as you indicated, some flexibility. Now, do you pass that on in terms of your interaction with your students and so on, your graduate students? Has that influenced your interactions with potential researchers?
Oh, absolutely, has influenced, and to the extent that I actually succeed giving back what I received, that I don't know, but I certainly try, but you know, I have my own rigidity to worry about. Of course, but you bet I try to repeat and to hold my side of the bargain and try to be as flexible to others as my teachers have been to me.
You know, it's interesting in this dialogue. I can feel and sense your energy and your passion for the research that you do and the things that excite you. And I know that your collaborators and those students that you influence as well would feel that same passion. So they'd be very excited to work with you, I think.
Oh, these are very passionate people. You're right.
Another question is that, you know, you worked with your colleague Shafi for some time, starting at Berkeley, and that collaboration has continued. You know, anytime you collaborate with somebody, sometimes there's tension, and how do you manage that tension? Or, you know, let's say if you disagree on a point of view, how do you manage that?
Well, the best thing is not to manage. Somehow tension gets resolved. Tension is good, right? So there are somehow you are pulled in two directions. But I think you generate energy. I think as long as there is goodwill, this energy gets released in a positive direction. I had never tried to be, quote, polite, end quote, in an interaction. It doesn't work for me. And other people have been very genuine when interacting with me. And I certainly, sometimes we start polite, but then as we become more and more friendly with one another, we become more and more direct, tension rises. And to tell you the truth, I think it's good. I don't think we should manage tension. If the tension becomes too high and we have to say go to hell for a day and I never work with you anymore, you can always restart the next day. But if you try to keep everything at a quite moderate tension level, I'm not sure. It may work for others, by the way. I don't want to dump on it, but it doesn't just work with me and with the people with whom I've been having the pleasure and the honor of working.
Now, in the past, your supervisors and collaborators, but also your mentors in the past, have given you a lot of flexibility, you know, sort of allowing this sort of oral tradition in terms of, you know, you proving that you have the expertise or the knowledge or you've done the required research or in your problem solving. You know, there's this new idea that came out of Stanford. Well, I guess it's not new, but it sort of got more attention back in 2011. That's this whole idea of massive open online courses, you know, where they had the artificial intelligence course, 160,000 students enrolled from 190 countries, volunteers translated in 44 languages. And MIT and Harvard had started something called edX, and it's sort of in that same area, or Coursera, and, you know, it's all about MOOCs. What's your opinion of MOOCs, and do you see that in conflict with the sort of the traditional side of teaching, or do you see it sort of aligned with how you were kind of mentored and the kind of support that you've received in your life?
So we have to be distinguishing here between the personal and what is good for me and what may be good for others. I tell you the truth, I really believe that enabling a very large audience to get educated is something extremely beautiful and extremely useful. Ideally, we'd like to do this on one-on-one, but if we cannot, then these online courses are perhaps a very good alternative. For me, actually, personally, it does not work, but this does not mean that it's good. Just I'll be very poor e-teacher. So remember that, you know, I continue to struggle on the fact of whether there is somebody on the other side, right? So I hate writing a letter, okay? Because, you know, who knows if the other one will ever receive it? And if you receive it, in what state of mood he or she is. So if I prefer a phone call to a letter anytime, and actually if it's something that is very important, I really insist on physical presence. And so the notion that I personally, I could go in front of a microphone and a camera and deliver a e-course, you know, give me, I shudder at the thought. But however, that does not mean that, you know, it's not good, that actually it may be just one way, but I really believe that there is going to be a room for this, you know, old-fashioned way of this, you know, as you say, is, you know, oral tradition or personal interaction, you know, between a small group of people, and that I believe that you can actually subliminally transmit so much more thoughts this way. Is just a way that it does not scale. So I don't want that in order to guarantee scale, we suppress this other mode, but we can certainly augment it with e-learning and remote learning. And I think that is, again, a beautiful beautiful project that I certainly applaud. I'm not sure that I'll be successful in this particular mode, but that's just me.
Again, illustrating your continuing leadership, one of the things you did was you co-founded the Information and Security Group. And because you're one of the co-founders of this very important group, can you detail your objectives in both the short and long term?
Actually, it was quite simple, really. So I think it is to foster interest, education and research in cryptography, pure and simple. I think that's what any group has been founded, and nowadays it's not different. It's just focuses on the cryptography that I still like, despite my recent adventures in mechanism design.
Now, throughout this interview, it's clear that you have a lot of energy that you put to different areas, and one of them is Advances in Computing Research, that five-volume textbook series. Why are you so supportive of that series? You know, what motivates you? What generates all of that passion?
So first of all, about the specific series, let me tell you right away that I'm very proud of that volume. The volume I edited was dedicated to randomness and computation, and I believe that the interplay of randomness and computation is crucial to our field, and I'm proud, actually, of the confidence bestowed upon me by its many contributors, which, by the way, are all great leaders in our field, and the editor of the entire series, you know, Franco Preparato. So I'm very proud of that volume. I liked it, and I still like it. But let me generalize, you know, your question a little bit, right? So I believe, you know, this volume, like, you know, other volume, in whatever form, because the form changes, I should say, occasions of common and focused reflection of what we try to understand are very important, right? And that is just, the volume is just one example. In a sense, we advance a given field and we have to do it by original technical contributions, but somehow we should, I find it also important that from time to time, we take a little bit of time to regulate our coordinates in our journey, right? So as the saying goes, what we know is at least as important as how we know it. And I could not agree more. Unfortunately, it's much more efficient to communicate only the slick proof of whatever we found, ignoring the tortuous path that usually leads to it. The path is forgotten, and that is a pity. And those with any experience of scientific discovery know only too well that such going is very far from slick and linear. Right? No one could exactly guess in advance the misconception, can figure out the conceptual barrier that preceded a solution. And so where were we conceptually beforehand? I find this to be a fascinating aspect of science too. And it is one which is very hard to reconstruct afterwards. So I personally do not subscribe to the theory that history helps us to avoid the mistakes of the past. If it does, it may only do only in part in a very indirect way. But I believe that in the history of ideas for its own sake, period. I mean, knowing, you know, humanity's past journey may actually make us a better man. And if we are better men, we can actually do better science. And all this may be true. But if it's not true, I don't care. I still want to know the history of our ideas. And that is actually because at the end I really believe that, you know, we develop one reality, but I don't believe that there is a single reality for us to discover over time. We just, you know, peeling off, you know, the reality. I think science is a very creative process. We always choose what to discover. And in a sense, we continually define our own scientific reality. I mean, most people like story, right? And I think that, you know, scientific development is really a fascinating story. So I really believe that once in a while, we should really find time to document the stage of the path at which we are in. I think that's important. It may slow us down a little bit, but it may also motivate us, right? Hopefully, it will not stifle us, right? So, because you start looking at your navel pretty much, you know, you don't look farther up anymore. But either way, I think it's a risk worth taking. And ultimately, if we don't care about how we got here, it's not clear to me that, you know, where we want to go may be important if you don't care about how we got here.
Sylvia, when I look at your profile of all the things that you've done in the past, it's just an incredible profile, just an inspiring list of contributions over so many years. And as a result, you've also won some awards and recognitions. So can you share some valuable experiences and lessons from their prior awards and recognition?
Well, okay. Valuable or not, you know, my experience is seems to be following track. First, I'm happy. Then I'm depressed. Then I meet other awardees and I feel better again. Okay, so that's the trajectory. And somehow I meet these other awardees for the first time, like you say, in the induction to an academy. And sometimes I actually have a first and very different discussions with people who I always thought of knowing. And because these are very motivated people, they tell me about their own goal. And these are their goals, not mine. But somehow I realize how worthy and clear these very personal and very different goals may be. And so somehow we live in a era of extreme specialization in science, right? Most of the time, you know, I don't even walk to another floor of our department, and even less to another department. So these are, I find these very special and very motivating moments.
Sylvia, you laid many of the foundational pillars in your pioneering work, and distilling from your experiences, what are the greater burning challenges and research problems for today's youth to solve, to inspire them to go into computing?
All right. So get in computing, because computation is everywhere. So perhaps computation is a mental construct, right, that we superimpose to the world, but then we only experience the world via ourselves.
So computation is everywhere in one way or another. So the real question that I'd like to know and trying to induce to solve is that to what extent can we use computation to understand physical, biological, and social laws? And can we perhaps use computation to influence some of these laws? I think these are very big questions, and we need all the manpower we can get to answer or to scratch at them, at their answers.
It's interesting. Your answer kind of reminds me of this folded game where, you know, there's these sort of problems of how proteins fold into enzymes, and now they use computers and just people. They crowdsource it, the solution, where they throw it out to masses of people, including middle schoolers, and they solve problems in this area that couldn't be solved by supercomputers and experienced researchers. Or there's this other online game which they're using to model economic behavior. So it's kind of interesting, this idea that, you know, computing is everywhere, and how can it influence some of the other domains that are out there, or how perhaps it is very important, all the other domains out there, and how can we sort of maybe further that work in some way?
Yep, I agree, but not only because somehow we can use humans to solve computational problems, but maybe, certainly in development, right, embryo development, I mean, somebody unfolds a problem one way or another, and, right, and, but even if you want to look at a particle, at the end, maybe a particle follows the laws, but maybe actually computes where it should be. I won't be surprised of that. So we really don't know. I really believe that computation is really the development of something, and if we ourselves and the universe and anything else is the development of something, I think there ought to be a bit more explanation to gain by understanding computations, and for sure in biological systems, but almost also everywhere else.
Now, again, because of the position that you hold in history and also in the computing field, but also many other domains, again, this question is directed regarding our youth. To our youth with an interest in the future of computing, but without the educational foundation, how would you explain your work?
All right. So I said that computation is everywhere. So, but perhaps I was not able to study much of it. So I chose to use computation to model, to study, and to augment our ability to interact with others. So I really used computation to cooperate with others while retaining our individuality, our secrets, and to efficiently convince others of what we laboriously found to be true. And that is that's my aspect of computation. That's the one I cherish. That's the one I develop. And our youth, every single one of you, you should find what is your aspect and develop that.
Now, what specific qualities make you excel and why?
So I'm going to be personal. I'm going to be very direct. And I'm going to be very brief, therefore, okay? So, five, I'd say the ability to convert emotions into science, creativity, admiration for the past, willingness to gamble the present, and yearning for the future.
Yeah, I like those answers.
Well, like it or not, these are my answers.
Now, past, present, or future, and you've already discussed this in a way, when you discussed your journey at the University of Rome and then at Berkeley, and all these sort of collaborators and people who mentored you and so on, but can you name three or more who inspire you, and why is this so?
Well, certainly, I mentioned a few names. You're right, Stephen, but actually, let it be known that we do not have this conversation without the tremendous influence of many other minds and friends. Right, so ultimately, we are the people who inspired us. And so there are a few other people who have not mentioned, but they really should be mentioned. One of them is Charlie Rakoff, right? Was the co-author with Shafi and me of Zero Knowledge Proofs. Odette Goldreich, with whom we co-authored Pseudo-Random Function. And independent of that, you know, just he had a great influence, in fact, a crucial influence from transforming a set of theorems in a new theory. And Avi Vigdason, without whom Zero Knowledge might have remained a quite limited intellectual enterprise. And Ron Rivest was the one actually who attracted Shafi and me at MIT and nurtured our career
and our intellectual development in innumerable ways. The list could, of course, go more. But this said, let me highlight three researchers whose research style really most impressed me, right? And these are Alan Turing, Manuel Blum, and Michael Rabin. And what I see in them is an innate ability of solving problems by conceptualization. That is, these guys internalize the problem so well, and they metabolize it so thoroughly, that at the end, all you have to do is to pick flowers in a sunny field. It is like magic. The problem solves itself. Now, this naturalness, of course, is very hard, and maybe a little bit artificial. You have to work very hard for it, but we should always strive towards it.
Sophia, we're down to our last two questions, and this is pretty open-ended, and I'm telling you, you choose the topic area, and then what do you see as the three top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Three top challenges. Well, you know, one top challenge should be enough for each one of us, right? Fortunately, there is many of us, so we ended up with many challenges. But let me try to multiply mine. So the top challenge I see today is, as I mentioned before, really solving the mystery of the brain. How do I propose to solve it? I don't have an exact recipe, but somehow I really believe that to go after the opportunity, education is going to be crucial. So now we have two challenges, the brain and education. So why I think they are correlated? Because I think perhaps the brain puzzle would be solved via one breakthrough or a cascade of great insight, very, very rapid processions. But we cannot sit down and wait for one of these to occur, right? So that is hardly a proposal. I'm not the only one to believe that computation would be crucial as biology for reaching a satisfactory understanding of the brain. I was telling you that Les Valiant has certainly given this a lot of thought too. In fact, actually, is maybe a main motivator for me to think about this idea. But the role of computation in this endeavor is still unclear. We need many more biologists with an intuitive doesn't mean simplistic, by the way, but intuitive means that you know it so well that it becomes second nature to you, and an intuitive understanding of computation, right? And we need plenty of computer scientists with an intuitive understanding of biology. I must admit that at least currently, I'm not one of them, right? But we don't need one person only, because we cannot put all the bets on one person. If we know who the right one is, so be it. But we need to bring up many and hope to actually have nurtured the one who really is going to solve the problems, right? So essentially what we need, education is crucial because we need to foster the synergy between biology and computation, and a synergy that at some point should really become the norm in science, right? And right now we are scattering and we are going deeper and deeper, and subfields is scary. So we need to put it together. And certainly for the brain, we should basically become crucial. So an attack in general, maximizing success, should include a strong interdisciplinary educational component. And education, I must say, is a challenge, was a challenge, and will always remain a challenge. I repeat here myself, actually, because I cannot stress education too much, right? People at the end use and are motivated only by what they know. And so we must continually revise what we know and how we teach what we know. And by understanding the world better, we are able to push knowledge and ideas earlier and earlier in our educational system, and more intuitively up to, say, middle school and even before. Why not? But then, you know, as a society, if we care a lot about the problem, we must also accelerate. We cannot just wait for just this natural populations, you know, in the early educational year. We may have to be creative here. And I think one way to be creative, who knows, is to have allow, for instance, the faculty members to teach a course, given the choice. You teach a course, or you take someone else's course in another discipline. In any case, to enable further and deeper advances, I think we should always find ways to generate shared knowledge more efficiently. Now, if I can go on a limb and mention another thing, but I think it's really a challenge, but that think of it much more as a psychological challenge, perhaps, but why not? I really think of it a main challenge, as I see it, is living outside our planet very soon. I view this as a psychological necessity. I think that there is great psychological harm in feeling trapped to the surface of a small physical sphere. And our sphere used to be much bigger not long ago. And of course, there are going to be other de facto infinities for us to explore, but you know, somehow physical exploration, I believe, is in our DNA. And I'm sure that if we go back to what I said, I might have used the journey as a metaphor several times. So I don't know if we can really survive this loss of quote infinite end quote physical journeys. I think we are going to be suffering a lot unless we find a solution.
Just very fascinating your take on that question. And now we're down to our last question. You've had this very long and distinguished career. You know, what are your top lessons that you want to share with the broad audience?
All right. If it is the last one, I'm going to revert to my cryptographic roots and being a little bit cryptic, if I may, but hopefully not too covert. So I really think that, you know, power is really the symbiosis of opposites. I believe that our emotions are our ultimate power and that nothing boils down to one thing.
That's a great closing set of lessons to pass on to her audience, and it reflects the individual that you are, the professional that you are, the remarkable scientist and researcher that you are. And I know your schedule is demanding it. You spent considerable time sharing your deep wisdom with our audience, and we are indeed fortunate, and thank you for coming in today.
Thank you, Stephen. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for your provocative questions.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Professor Silvio Micali, ACM Turing Award winner recipient in 2013, and the Turing Award is widely considered the Nobel Prize in Computing. Professor Silvio Micali is also a world-renowned, distinguished researcher and professor at MIT.